Oak Room Meetings, Buddhist Summer School, 1973, Monday, 27th August, 1973.
The body. We think of it usually in terms of separation. This is body, this is not me, we say. This is mind, and so on and so on. Because we are conditioned right from childhood to regard the body, the mind, in these terms, in separate terms, we carry this error with us permanently throughout our life. It has become ingrained. Then as we grow older, if we are interested along such lines, we are told there is the conscious mind, there is the unconscious mind, and so on. And we talk of them, we are aware of them in terms of separateness. The separateness is real in the sense that the heart inside the body is certainly different from the liver, it's different from your knee, and so on. But it is integral part and parcel of one unitary whole. It is so easy to take a phrase like that and let it produce a superficial ripple at the surface of the brain. And we say, oh yes, I see, I agree with that. Or one may say, no, I don't agree with that. But this is not the way of understanding. This is just a superficial intellectual tickle, an itch, almost. Really to understand, one has to allow what one sees or hears or reads, etc., to penetrate right into our innermost sensitivity. Now our innermost by that term innermost sensitivity, I do not mean some sort of special organ which is inside us. Another little separate bit of machinery. It isn't that. The whole living body is sensitive. And this sensitivity is a receptive and responsive sensitivity. It functions naturally. It is there on its own. And it is not exclusive to us as individuals. We cannot regard it as our own individual property. It is universal. And it is universal in the sense that the matter which composes the body comes out of the universal stock of matter in the world. It's the same hydrogen, oxygen, and so forth, which makes up the planet, this large pattern, the globe on which we live, which makes up the body too. And we have this sensitivity, which perhaps is a good way of trying to understand the nature of mind. We use the word mind quite easily. Do we know what we mean by mind? What is mind? I remember about 50 years ago reading a book on psychology in which this question of matter and mind was discussed. And it started off with an imaginary conversation between two people. And one person asked this very question, what is mind? And the answer was, no matter. Now, what is matter? Never mind. You see, this sensitivity is mind, if you like to approach it that way. But this sensitivity, this mind, is the very cells of the body. That sensitivity is a characteristic of the living organism. If what we call the body, bones, blood, flesh, cells, atoms, if you like, molecules, atoms, if that were not there, this sensitivity would not manifest. If this sensitivity were totally absent, it would be totally absent because the atoms themselves are totally absent. We in modern times, learning science, think, oh yes, we know all about it now, these atoms, and we sort of picture them. We've given up the billiard ball concept, although we are a playful nation. And we have taken to different ideas, you know, where's your nucleus, the protons, and all the rest of it. Still we make, to use the old word, a materialistic picture of the atoms. But try and let the nature of those atoms enlighten one's own understanding. An atom. Can you feel it out with this sensitivity, which is mind, which is mind power? All matter, we say, used to say, is electrical in origin. We have gone much further than that now, and we are pretty assured of the interchangeability of the two terms, matter, energy. Energy becomes matter, and matter can be totally annihilated into energy. It's a curious thing. A particle of matter is energy concretized. Energy is matter completely subtilized. It's that sort of thing. Now, so too with this body-mind organism, this nama-rupa, as we call it in Buddhist terms and in Hindu terms, nama-rupa, name, form, and the impersonal presentation in Buddhism is remarkably good. It appeals particularly to the intellectual, scientific type. Mentality materiality. When you look at nama rupa as mentality materiality, the sense of I, a person, an entity, there, a self which you cling to, one is easy to be a little bit free of that feeling. This is a phenomenon of mentality materiality. So now, when I release the feeling in the body, I do not use it in the old limited sense of just a material body, separate from my mental body or spiritual body and so forth. The body. Now, the Buddha said, he who lives without harming himself, without harming others, lives with a self become Brahman. That is an extraordinary statement to make. If one meditates upon it deeply and is able to be lighted up from within with its tremendous significance, one will see all sorts of things. He who lives not harming himself, not harming others, lives with a self, become Brahman, the absolute all, the total reality. And he uses the word Brahman there, obviously, in the Upanishadic sense. The totality, Brahman. The one and only total reality, which does not deny multiplicity in manifestation. That must be borne in mind. Commentators and expositors of the Upanishads have time and again slipped up there. They have presented verbally what Brahman means, what the word stands for, in a way which implies otherness. On the one hand, they say Brahman is the all, then they proceed to say Brahman, etc., etc., this, thus, thus, thus. And the final conclusion, logical conclusion, can only be it is other than this. Well, then it is not, it does not contain the all, obviously. Yes. The self becomes Brahman. But can this self, this thing here, become Brahman? In the way, in the sense in which we ordinarily use the word become. Well, obviously it can't. The planet is the planet, you are you, the chair is the chair. This doesn't become that. But let us look into this. If I am in the harmless condition, not harming self, and not harming others, and you are looking on, what will you see? You will see that this self is integral part and parcel of the whole thing. This body, is it merely this body? Aren't there constant interchanges, actual and physical, solid, liquid, gaseous, between any one body and the environment in which that body lives? we bring it right into the physical plane, at the physical level, we see that there are these constant interchanges, these constant interrelationships. Substantially, it is now. When this body is awake and self-conscious, normally the self-consciousness is so isolated that it stops at the confines of the skin bag which holds this thing. What is my body? Surely it's the totality. This is the mystery, the marvel, the wonder of totality, the wonder of actual reality. That it is the one, but includes the many. All in terms of relationship. The subsistence of the one is possible only by virtue of the innumerable many. This is something which we must realize very sensitively, deeply in our consciousness. What we call the other person is indeed the other person, and at the same time he is another version of me, just as I am another version of him. And over and above that, there is this wonderful all-inclusive relationship which makes the two persons, the 20, the 20 million, the 2,000 millions on the globe, all one mankind. These are not just pleasant ideas, if they are pleasant at all. These are not just ideas. You can look at it, you can see it, and you can be sensitive to it without seeing it lopsidedly. Those who are emotionally perhaps driven by their feelings merely, they are good feelings, they are good heart, they say, oh yes, we are all brothers and all the rest of it. But you know, those brothers very soon reach the fisticuffy stage. In fact, some brothers can only show they are loved that way. But that is not it. One has to be very balanced, very calm, and see this unity as it actually is, in fact, the nature of the unity. This complete relationship all the time. But this relationship one wakes up to through this extraordinary sensitivity that lies in every organism. I learnt a lot from our kittens who were born just a couple of months ago. No, they're about 3 months old, aren't they? Yes. You know, these little things perfectly trustfully and naturally just come along and put their noses into your into your hands or your face or anything. Just completely trustfully. And they are sensitive to the living person. If he is, at least in part, a non-harming type, The kitten just comes and completely gives itself to you like that, makes the bond, doesn't get frightened of you, doesn't run away from you. It's quite an extraordinary thing. Not harming oneself, remember that, that's very important. Not harming others. One lives with a self, become Brahma. What is the origin, the root source of becoming harmful to others? Surely the separation in mind. One is conscious in terms of separation. You're different, you're other, out. It emanates as a force from the person. And the sensitivity of the animal feels it and just naturally reacts accordingly. Runs away, is frightened, has a feeling that will hurt me. Now we have talked a good bit about the sense of wholeness. We talk in terms of a universe, of a one reality. But this is in the realm of words, the realm of discursive thought, which, as Dhammadinna said to Visakha, is merely an activity of speech, not an activity of mind. Feeling and perception is activity of mind. Mind is the medium which enables universality to be realized through any one living being in the universe. It took human beings, did it not, to see a universe. My very trusting, charming little affectionate kitten knows nothing about the universe. It knows a lot about milk or anything like that, and says meow at once. Response. That's as far as its response goes. That's its natural capacity, and that is all. And it fulfills itself to the uttermost within the limits of its natural capacity. What is our natural capacity? Not to be confined in mind, in consciousness, to this little skin bag. Mind can see and understand a universe. But the power of this concretized energy to restrict vision is so great that it tends to prevent me from seeing unconcretized energy and being in relation to it. But where shall we start from in order to see this? Isn't the body the best? Now I'm using the word body in the conventional, ordinary sense. Isn't that the best starting point? In fact, is it really possible for me to have a different starting point? Here I am at this moment, in this room. Supposing I want to go to London. Have I any option but to start from here? Because I happen to be here. If I were in Saffron Walden, then I'd start from Saffron Walden. If I were 20 yards from my house, I start from 20 yards from my house to get to my house. All right, what is my house? What is my home?
You know that hymn, O God, our help in ages past, the fourth line, and our eternal home. What is our eternal home? The man-projected mysterious entity named God, or the reality of God, the totality that is. And isn't the reality, the totality, the body? Have we not, through the centuries, in taking to the religious life, insulted the body? This vesture of flesh, this thing of decay, and so on. One of the questions which may naturally arise in your mind is this. What about the foulness meditation prescribed in Buddhist training? Regard the body as a source of foul things. Yes, indeed. The healthy body is attractive externally, charming. It may have a sweet smell. We all know that somebody's hair smelled absolutely marvelous when we were very young. It was like a perfume and so forth. But if we penetrate inside, then the Buddhist texts point out, oh, there's blood, there's pus, there's feces, there's urine, there's all sorts of foul, there are all sorts of foul things. But can the beautiful thing be without containing the foul thing? The beautiful thing subsists because these so-called foul things function properly. If they cease to function properly, even the beautiful part becomes, well, not quite so beautiful. We have to use our good sense all along the line. I think you've heard me say this year after year, one of the basic rules, foundational rules of the spiritual life, never take leave of good sense. And Prabhupada said, there are too many who do that when they take to the spiritual life, the religious life. Which really means the human life, because man fundamentally is a religious being, and only secondarily is he a social, political, economic animal. The being which is man is a religious creature. This evolved from the ancestral primate is the animal. Animal is a perfectly good, wonderful thing. The being is a perfectly good, wonderful thing. One is not superior to the other. It's only when this religious being in this animal vehicle is not quite in harmony that the trouble starts. There is discord, there is conflict, and all the rest of it, and there is illness. In fact, this itself gets into that state where I harm it all along the line. And in harming it, I harm the whole body. I harm it principally because in my own awareness, I divide it from the body or the spirit or the soul or whatever word you like.
You know, that's the original meaning of the word sin. Whatsoever is thought or said or done in order to sunder the fundamental unity of the universe is sin. That is sin. That is the sinful state. So, not harming oneself, not harming others. If I have learned not to harm myself, I have learned it simply because I have grown out of this constricting outlook upon and said, this is me and that is not me. I have grown out of that and become the whole in awareness. And if I have become the whole thing, then there is no other to harm. The totality is here. And that realization of totality takes place not because a separately and isolatively self-conscious I has realized that totality. But the totality has realized itself through an unresisting, that is, a harmless me. Every day, every night I mean, practically every human being realizes the harmless state in dreamless slumber. Some of you whose interests include the religions of the world as a whole know how in the Upanishads they talk of the four states of consciousness, the four avasthas, which have their correspondences in Buddhist teaching in terms of the four jhanas and the four samapattis. And the Upanishads present it this way: there is the ordinary waking state, like we are in now. The ordinary waking state. Then there is the dream state when you sleep, or when you're awake but lost in the clouds, as we say, you know. The dream state, the fantasy state. It is identical, really, the fantasy state and the dream state. Then there is the dreamless slumber state. And they call this a deep, a wonderful state. Because then they say the Atma goes back to its home. But the Atma is defined as that which is the totality. The Atma, as you will find in the, particularly in the big Upanishads like the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya, is birthless, ageless, deathless, hungerless, thirstless, sorrowless, stainless. And all those words are used by the Buddha in that 26th Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, that famous Ariya Pariyesana Sutta, which is the autobiographical Sutta of the Buddha. And he says, seeking the unborn, the unaging, the undecaying, the undying, the unsorrowing, the stainless, which is the uttermost security from the bonds, Nibbana. He realized all those things.
the actual verbal formulation could be improved, considerably improved, in one or two respects, but we won't quibble about that at the moment. But is not this, which he sought, identical with the way in which the Upanishadic holy ones spoke of the Atma? This is how the Buddha spoke of Nirvana, the unborn, unbegotten, etc., etc. And that is how those people spoke about the Atma. Is there any difference between the things? The identical adjectives are used. It's a very significant fact. It's a case of becoming sensitive then to this whole being. And we'll start from here with the body. Let's spend a few minutes letting the mind be at rest, at peace. And just let us be sensitively awake to the reality of the body. And then in the waking state, there is the realization of what they spoke of in the Upanishads in the dreamless slumber state. The importance of that is this, that this rather absurd division between the unconscious and the conscious is out. There is only one mind. There are no barriers of conscious and unconscious in reality. So when you realize that in the waking state, there are tremendous implications in it. We may perhaps consider those just a little. Now, let that breath rhythm get established. Feel perfectly at ease in what we call our own body. Now first let us see that it is this very body, what we call our own body, which is the source of the expression of greed, of violence, and so forth. And that greed is first associated with food. Within a few moments after I am born, I am put to my mother's breast. And I sustain myself and I go on sucking till I'm absolutely replete, unless I'm stopped. And if I'm stopped in a manner which I resent, I feel violence, hate. Greed and hate start from the beginning through the body. Refused mother's breast for some reason or other. And there is anger. Which the infant expresses in a loud voice. Just reenact in your mind's eye this which happens, and at the same time feel it happening sensitively. Here we see the roots of aversion. And then reenact again sensitively, feelingly, the source of attachment. All the pleasant sensations that come from the mother, from those around, and so forth. And we like them. And we get attached to them and want them repeated. Repetitiveness belongs to the realm of mortality. And it is the psychological impress which raises up, on the one hand, attachment, on the other hand, aversion. Examples of the source of these things. When you meditate by yourselves, you can work it all out in your own way. Note another factor, a very important factor.
as we grow and we have the parents' attention just to ourselves, there arises the feeling of possessiveness, of appropriation, which is in actual fact a misappropriation, but the infant doesn't know anything about that. There is this sense of appropriation. This is my mother, my source of pleasure. And if another child or anything comes in the way, there is aversion, there is anger, there is jealousy. I'm confining our considerations just to attachment and aversion. We'll leave aside fear and various other things because it's too much to consider all at once. So you see, this sense of the other one, the interloper, the intruder, the enemy, grows up. And still another factor. In the beginning, there is no I am I consciousness at all. If you watch carefully, the child is aware of itself more in terms of it, the baby, or by its own name, which it hears constantly. And in its mind, its self-reference is to the name and to baby, or whatever it is. This happens to every one of us. And it is only later on that the pronouns come in. I, you, he, and so forth. The personal pronoun. And this complex grows up in the mind that I am I, he is he, and so forth and so forth. The complex which emphasizes differentiation with no idea or awareness, no sensitivity to the profounder relationships which make for the unity. And then this extends to all objects and the daily experiences, eating, drinking, sleeping, playing, and so on and so on. So that the complex which grows up in the mind is in terms of analysis, of differentiation, of separation. Notice how peculiarly this is reflected in the way we play as children. If a toy is given to us, our tendency is to take it to pieces and see what they are. We take to pieces. Then we try
to put them together again, find that we can't, and we are very frustrated. And again, anger arises. All these are pretty trivial things. You all know about them and so forth. But what we are trying to do now is not to know them superficially, with the surface layer of brain cells, but to be intensely sensitive to the fact. Because it is this sensitivity which is our power of salvation. It might be useful at this point to call to mind somebody who, I mean, when we were very little children, somebody who was disliked very much by us. Whatever the reason for the dislike may be, it's not very important. But I disliked that very much, hated him. You can reenact the feeling which was present then. Now that oneself is adult and grown up, reenact that feeling with real sensitivity, you will find that that complex which lives in the hinterland of the mind as a force, as a destructive force, the demon inside us, the psychical energy which has become distorted, will get combed out, it will get straightened out, it will become purified. And hate, that is to say, the expression of psychical energy, which we named hate, will become transformed. Don't fall into the trap of thinking it becomes transformed into its opposite. No. It will become transformed. Just see if you can achieve anything right now. Sensitively feel that conflict, that hate. Be intensely aware of it, intensely aware. Don't add to it by imagination merely, but the actual fact, this is how it was, this is how it happened. Let the mind be still as it looks on. And you will find compassion welling up. Compassion which equally covers, enfolds, and heals oneself and the hated one. All right, rest a moment. Just be quite quiet.
let it come to the surface of the conscious mind. I'm using the phrase of differentiation. This compassion comes up and heals. And there is no question of forgiving or forgetting. Those are only ways of shifting the conflict. That locked up psychical energy becomes transformed. Do avoid, like poison, thinking of it in terms of hate is changed into love. Yeah. Within the realm of manifestation, there is always the duality, the love-hate complex as we call it. Love in the transcendent sense is neither of these. It is the transcendence of both of them. And the transcendence of both of them takes place by seeing into any one aspect of it. If you look into hate like this, dispassionately, and transform it, you will have transformed its dual, what we call love, also at the same time. Because in the state of duality, the one dual exists by virtue of its opposite. Otherwise it doesn't exist as a dual. It exists and manifests in its transcendent reality, in which there is no conflict, there is no dukkha, there is no ill state. You see this? You see, the texts tell us that meditate on this and it will free you from its opposite. Meditate thus when anger... You know, there are some very, very valuable and very interesting suttas in the Buddhist texts telling us how to tackle problems like this which rise up. The Majjhima has at least two which I know of. You see? But I think that the verbal formulation is a little bit misleading. You see, because the verbal formulation in the suttas is such that it talks in terms of counteraction. Now, counteraction in any and every case means conflict. You never solve the problem like that. You raise up an either-or situation. And you exercise a preferential choice with respect to the either or with respect to the or, you see? But in exercising a preferential choice, you have pushed aside, or tried to push aside, the rest of it. But you can't push anything out of the cosmos. Everything is there. I can sweep the dirt and shove it under the carpet, but the dirt is there. So that is not the way. This is the way of transmutation. This is the way of allowing this transcendent creative energy which lies at the root of all existence to do the job. You see, I can never realize. It is that, the mysterious unknown, which achieves, realizes, perfects everything through me. What I do, my technique, if you like, is the technique of removing obstacles concretized in this skin bag. Do you get it? So you see, the meaning of my words, this sensitivity is your power of salvation. The sensitivity is always there. What you and I, as human individuals, specially have to do is to combine that with attentiveness, mindfulness, the right kind of attentiveness, the totally dispassionate, not taking sides attentiveness. You give yourself to totality, to reality, to truth, to the ultimate, and that mysterious power does the job. And you start off then from here, from the body. How aversion has arisen, how attachment has arisen, how the sense of otherness has arisen. Dukkha arises out of this. But now look at something else. Consider something else. Dukkha arises out of this, right enough. But is there any other way but through this by which nirvana finds realization? If there wasn't that skin bag full named Siddhartha Gautama, would there have been the emanation of Buddha? Impossible. Because there was that skin bag full of dukkha, and because we as human beings have this extraordinary capacity to look into ourselves and recognize a selfhood in which we are still ignorant of the fact, the totality is embodied, because of that, once we recognize that this is dukkha and how it arises, in that recognition, that intensely sensitive mindfulness, the transformation of the dukkha-ness into nirvana-ness takes place by itself. But you see, the way the paths have been presented, and this, I'm afraid, exists in all the religious sort of technical teachings in the world. It dogs all the religions of the world. This path in terms of counteraction. Recognizing that, oh, I am jealous, I must root out jealousy. I can't. I can look at it within and feel it with intense sensitivity, not be opposed to it, resist not evil, said Jesus. Not be opposed to it, not be an enemy to it, but just look at it with this intense sensitivity until this mysterious compassion wells out from within. This is mindfulness, at least as far as I see it. This is mindfulness in the supreme sense. This is the way one wields spiritual energy. the way of purification, because the way of purification is the way of salvation. What are the salving is there to do? Salving is healing, to make whole, to make holy. Then, when one sees that, one begins to understand the reality that this is transcendence embodied. Then one sees the meaning of those statements in the Skanda and the Maitreya Upanishads, to give just two examples from India, that the body is the temple. He who officiates in the temple is Shiva himself. The third person of the Hindu Trinity. And you know what the word Shiva means? The name Shiva means the benign one, the auspicious one, the one who is Lord of reproductive nature and also the Lord of ascetics. What does, and who is the ascetic? The ascetic who sees that such and such is unnecessary. It is useless. There is no grasping. The ascetic grasps at nothing. Because he knows this is the whole world. What is he to grasp at? And therefore, all the evil which comes into being through this graspingness undergoes the ascesis, the removing of the unnecessary. And the unnecessary is our ignorance, our illusion, our delusion. And with it goes greed and hate and the whole jingdang lot of it. So Shiva is the Lord of ascetics. And at the same time, he's the Lord of reproductive nature. And he who is Lord of asceticism is ever virgin, although he's also Lord of all reproduction, of all creation. Now you see the meaning of chastity, purity, perfection. You'll appreciate why the Buddha said to Ananda, Ananda, and this is deathlessness, namely the cessation of all grasping. This is Nibbana, he said. I think it comes in the, at least it's in the third volume of the English translation, by Horner, Dr. Horner. And I'm not quite sure whether it is the sutta entitled On Beneficial Imperturbability. Never mind, you'll find it in the third volume if you care to look through it. You see? So now, how one ceases to harm oneself. What we have tried out in this very elementary way is just a suggestion of what you could do if you are drawn to it. It rests with you. Look, but the principle will remain true. You have to see, you have been intensely mindful, intensely sensitive, and completely dispassionate. Then the thing happens on its own. The necessity for dispassion is just this, that if desire is involved, I want to be free of ill,
oh, I want to help humanity or serve God, cut the whole lot out. It's all nonsense. Just let life live. Body implies mind completely and totally. All this cannot be done apart from the element which we choose to call mind. For me, body, mind, spirit, all these words are not separate things at all. There is only this extraordinary totality, this reality, this utter wholeness of everything. It is my vijnana, my conditioning from childhood onwards, which produces this worm in the apple. Separateness. This sinful state of dividing, division making. What was Lucifer's sin? Was it merely aspiration to equality with the Almighty? Not a bit of it. But that aspiration to equality with the Almighty, the great, I better not say it, I might tread upon the toes of certain party members, equality, you know what I mean. It was not that, but its implication. How can I aspire to equality with anything or anybody, unless to me that thing or person is different and separate from me? That is the sin. The attempt to cut asunder in two that which is one. If this sensitivity grows, really comes to fruition in you, your whole being, your whole life becomes a well of compassion, real well of compassion. Nothing emotional, nothing sentimental about it. Compassion is a mysterious power which we don't know, and it's not necessary. That compassion will go out. And this compassion heals. Makes whole all the time. But our difficulty is, particularly in connection with personal relationships, the dear one, and we get emotionally involved, and we want the dear one to be saved this, that and the other trouble. We want the dear one to be thus and thus and thus. Who am I to want anybody to be thus and thus and thus? Supposing the Lord God said, my dear Feroz, what are you talking about? Don't you come interfering with what I want. What then? See, this sinfulness lies right at the deeps of our consciousness. This tendency to separate, to cut asunder. I, the not I. The self, the not self. We talked about that yesterday, you remember. So now in the harmless state, and I'll come back to this dreamless slumber state. All of you who are parents have watched your child in the state of dreamless slumber, sleeping happily, in complete harmony with its environment. That little living thing, not harming anything or anybody. You and I in dreamless slumber.
Every night are like that. In the real depths of slumber, we are at ease, completely at ease. There is no intrusion of personal desire anywhere in dreamless slumber. And it is the intrusion of personal desire of any sort which produces the divided state. If you understand this, you will understand why Hinduism and Buddhism particularly have talked of desirelessness. Any and every desire, the so-called good and the so-called bad desire. Because that's all in the realm of the unresolved, the discordant state, the duality, where things can flare. Now, this resolution of the discord, always present or imminent or threatened in the state of duality, the resolution of this discord is the actual transmutation of any one aspect of the dual. You can look at your virtues, so-called. Supposing you are a very amiable, kind person. And we say, oh, he has the virtue of kindness, or the virtue of generosity. Yes, it is virtue in the dualistic sense only. We are caught in this realm of ambivalence, and we never escape it, unless and until one shoots through in vision to the totality. Now, in this ambivalent state, look at your virtue of kindness. Look at it completely. Don't approve of it, otherwise you'll just expand this way with spiritual pride. You see? Just look at it with intense sensitivity, and you will find compassion for yourself for possessing the virtue of kindness. When that compassion has really worked itself out, and when with right wisdom you cease to grasp, that's in one sentence, it contains everything, you cease to grasp at virtue, you will also be freed of its opposite, which we call vice. Then you are out of this ambivalent state, but you're not out there or anywhere else. Right here, this ambivalence has been transformed into... Now this is where I always get stumped. There are no words in any language to describe this transcendent state. And the word transcendent always gives the feeling, oh, it's other than. No, it's not other than. It's the same thing becomes so totally different that description is out. You can't describe it. You can use a word like the divine state or any word like that, but can't decide. And this is the liberated state. This is the state of freedom. Freedom which is the crown of the spirit in man. And this is the virtuous state, the meaning of virtue. It's natural, it is of the very nature of the reality. You don't have to acquire it, you cannot acquire it, you cannot search for this virtue. You get rid of your virtues and your vices. You observe them like this with intense sensitivity and intense mindfulness. And this, which is the troublemaker, has ceased to be the troublemaker. He who lives not harming himself, not harming others, in this state of harmlessness, lives with a self become Brahman. Just try and feel this out by yourselves for a few moments. I'll be perfectly silent. Let me repeat what I said yesterday. After the intense stage, which we might also call the concentrated stage, let a quietness prevail. And the psyche gets recharged with energy. in dreamless slumber, we get recharged with the strength. That is why we wake up refreshed, as we say. And after this sort of thing, if there has been the real intensity plus sensitivity, the whole psyche is recharged. But the psyche is a very sensitive thing, very fine something. And you see, when we move out into the psychical atmosphere which the world batters us, we tend to react, to blow up, to feel things worse than ever. So maintain the quiet, and in that quietness you will find that there is no psychical armor plating which builds up, but an extraordinary power of absorptiveness grows in you. You absorb everything. You know that wonderful symbolism in Hindu teaching. Both Shiva and Vishnu drink of the poisoned cup of the world's sorrow to its dregs and transmute it in their being. You can do that. If you absorb it into your psyche, which is in peace and in harmony, the non-harming state, that which is poisonous, which is harmful, gets transmuted through you. It is also your own safeguard. In that way you learn to care for everybody and everything without anxiety.